Ansel Dickey, it is a pleasure to have you on the Single Track Podcast, and it's great to meet. How are you doing today?
Pleasure to be here. Also great to meet. This is low-key my first real, I would say, podcast interview ever. I was on the Breakfast with Boz show a long time ago, but Ian's a really good friend, and I think he did it out of charity, so I'm flattered to be here.
Given how much I know about you and how much I've followed your work, I would have thought that this would have been the 15th or the 20th interview you've done. So anyways, glad we can be one of the first. There's a lot to talk about when it comes to event directing, your background as a pro athlete, content person, the Walmsley film, the Vermont scene. I want to start here though. I was watching the Walmsley film the other day and I noticed a scene where he opens the fridge at his chalet in Beauforton and there's a can of Hetty Topper in there. Was that your doing?
It's so funny because I don't read a lot of the comments, but the one or two times I've kind of scrolled through what people have been saying, that's like the one thing that a lot of people are picking up on, like this kind of Easter egg in the film. They're like, where did you get the Hetty Topper from? Or how did you get a Hetty Topper in France? And I got all these texts from like these, like some of my friends who, like some like bachelor party boys. They're like, dude, how did you get Hetty Topper? That's crazy. That's so funny. And, yeah, long story short, I brought him a 4-pack in my checked luggage and as like a gift because I was going and I think I was actually staying with them for that portion of the shoot in their tiny little chalet, just me. So I brought them like a gift from Vermont. And I know that Jim really loves beer. One of the shoots we did at his house in Flagstaff, Arizona, we shared a bunch of Pliny the Elders, which is like the West Coast version of Hetty Topper. And that was one of the first shoots I did with him and we kind of bonded over that. So I was like, oh, I'm going to France. I got to bring him like Vermont's favorite beer. And I brought it to him. He actually didn't like it that much. He thought it was too bitter, but he wasn't down with the 8.5%, whatever percent, but it was a cool, like subtle way to like, I don't know, slip some Vermont into the film. And we could have so easily, like, I don't know, not included that. It's like one cut. It's like a 2-second clip, but it's cool to see that people actually picked up on it.
I guess I have to go back and read the comment section now, but did you get any criticism like, oh, dude, you should have brought Focal Banger, or like, how do you overlook Hill Farmstead?
That Hill Farmstead is a good one. That would have been a more classy decision. but I feel like the classic, like everyone knows Hetty Topper and that's probably why. But no, I haven't seen if anybody's like been like, oh, why didn't you bring this one? But I thought the like bright kind of silver can with the graphic was visually, it would have made people notice. So I thought it was fun.
How did this film come about? How did you connect with Walmsley? How did you connect with Wahoo? Talk about that whole backstory.
Yeah, 100%. So I run like a very small production house called Overland Studio. It used to be called Vermont Social back in the day. We just rebranded the name because less than 5% of the work we do is actually in Vermont. Like we just do a lot of stuff around the US and around the world. So Wahoo Fitness has been one of our biggest clients for a long time. And we had been working with them for like 2 or 3 years when the Walmsley project kind of started. And at that time, I was working with this guy, Matt Porter, who was the head of content there. And we were super close, doing a lot of projects. And Wahoo had yet to come out with any running specific product. So they had roadmapped the Rival, which is like their GPS watch. And that was getting released. And they needed an athlete to sign to like announce that product. And announced like they had no like specific running athletes. They had a lot of triathletes because of the kicker and like indoor training. But they signed Jim. And Jim doesn't like to work with a lot of partners, which I think is really cool. He's like, okay, if I can get like one or two partners to just like pay the bills and I don't have to like manage relationships or like answer emails throughout the rest of the year, that's awesome. So Wahoo was one of those like big partners for Jim, which is really cool to see. And I think Jim was willing to sign up with Wahoo because he saw a lot of the content that they did. They're like, oh, they can actually maybe tell my story in a cool way. So that was one of Matt Porter's really big goals. It's like, we got to do some cool stuff with this guy. He's rad. And neither, like, I'm not a runner. I'm an ex-professional cyclist. I now love running. I've like fallen in love with the sport, but total noob. Don't follow the sport enough to like name drop anything. I show up to this first gym shoot. It's just like a photo shoot, just to get some like assets to launch the new product, to announce like the partnership with gym. And Matt and I travel to Flagstaff, and Matt and I know each other great. We're like, get there the night, we stay in this hotel. We wake up the next morning, we're like texting back and forth with Jim. Neither of us have like met him before. I didn't do any homework. I don't follow the sport. So I'm like completely like out of the clue. I'm like, oh, okay, just flew to Arizona to do a shoot. It's going to take 2 days and I have to fly home. And I was kind of like, I had this chip on my shoulder that like ultra running was kind of like this weird sport that people just wanted to kind of like speed walk through the woods. And like, I had no idea what the sport actually was and how heroic and cool and just like insane it is. So, and I didn't know how much of a badass Jim was. So I show up to this first shoot, and Jim rolls up in his like super sick 4Runner rig with an Alucab rooftop tent, like lifted on 35-inch tires and like full camping set up. It's got the like Southwest patina on it. And he gets out and he's like this handsome dude who's ripped and is like, okay, boys, let's go. We're going to go hit this spot. It's going to have beautiful light and we're going to go hit this spot. And Matt and I are like looking at each other like, oh my gosh, dude, like, who is this guy? This is crazy. He's so cool. So that was kind of like the first iteration of the product projects with him. And then shortly thereafter, we did that first Walmsley installment, which is like kind of who he is, what is he doing, based in Flagstaff, Arizona, and around the Grand Canyon. So, and then it just kind of like evolved from there. I think like Matt had an idea that throughout the whole series, UTMB was always kind of like the looming goal, but it was a really like an evolution of the project. Like we just like, we did that first shoot. It got a really good response. We did that first like short film. It got like a crazy good response, has over like 300,000 views now. So we just like kept doing more projects with him, and Hoka got involved to like start splitting some of the costs on the project, because like Hoka was his other big partner. Yeah. And it just like evolved from there. We did that third Walmsley film where they wanted to like double down on UTMB and film the whole thing. And he lost, he like dropped out or got fourth or something. And then like full circle, we get to 2023 and start talking about projects. And Walmsley's still, Jim is still like a big Wahoo athlete. So they're like, okay, let's do one more year of like filming to like document the entire process, make a feature length film, repurpose all the footage that we've already had and shot and used. And hopefully he can pull it together one last time. And if he doesn't, whatever. And he just goes and happens to win, which is just like the most mind blowing thing. And it like ties up the film beautifully and like this huge, almost 4 year long project. So very cool to see it kind of complete now and see people's responses.
Thanks to NAC, the official nutrition partner of Singletrack, for supporting this episode. We are just a few days away from the 2024 Cocodona 250, where I'll be racing primarily with their products, including the Ultra Energy Drink Mix, waffles, and purees. And in the last few days pre-race, I'll be reviewing my aid station refueling plan via the nutrition app on their website. If you're unfamiliar, it's pretty cool. You can enter the next race you have on the calendar, input data like your sweat rate, finish goals, height and weight, and other factors. That's going to provide you with a plan dialed for what's on course on race day. It's awesome. I encourage you to check it out. Additionally, if you end up buying some product to train and race with, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK15 at checkout on their website for 15% off your next order. That's NAAK, NAAK.com. And with that, let's get back to the preview episode with Ansel Dickey. I have so many follow-up questions. Maybe the most basic one, what's your interpretation of Walmsley after spending a lot of time with him? Like, you had this initial meeting that you described so perfectly of, you know, showing up in this souped up 4Runner, totally ripped, like just ready to get after it in the mountains, independent of who is around him, because he's just so true to the game. He keeps the main thing the main thing.
But like most people would be, if you tell like a normal person, like, hey, we're going to meet here at 5 a.m. to go get good light, you're like bracing yourself for them to be like super tired, annoyed, and like not happy to be there. And Jim was just like so stoked. It was awesome. So it was a really good first impression.
And how about as you got to work with him over the months and years, like how did your relationship change? What were some of the insights into his way of life and personality that stuck with you?
I think we just kind of hit it off. He has a really quirky and fun, weird sense of humor. And I don't find myself like humorous, but like, I really like having a good time and laughing with people and joking and like keeping it light. So we just had like a great time together filming and would like shoot the shit and like joke about stuff, and talk about sport and life. So I think like our relationship definitely added a lot to the film. Like it didn't feel like work when we're like working. But to your question about what did my perspective of him, how did it kind of evolve throughout the process? I just have so much more respect for athletes of that level now. Like, and still, I think this was a big part of like what made the film the way it is me approaching it from this like new beginner mindset of like, I don't really know what the sport is. So I'm like very curiously asking questions the whole time, trying to explain it in the film. And like, you don't want to have him explain it in like the most dumbed down way for someone who's literally never done a sport before in their life, but you need to like explain it to a broader audience, because the way these films are going to like, or the way the sport is going to grow and these films are going to be seen by more people is just like appealing to a broader audience. Like the film Free Solo, you know, like Alex Honnold does a crazy thing and it's like tailored to a bigger audience than just like the niche kind of rock climbing crowd. So that was kind of the goal the whole time. And my respect for him just evolved. Like the people who do this sport is crazy. They run around this mountain, it's 100 miles, and they're like dropping 6 minute flat miles at mile 80. It's like, how are they doing it? It's like gladiator type stuff. So yeah, the relationship's just evolved, and like I'm proud to call him like a good friend now. And I just have like a lot of respect for those athletes, because it's just mind-blowing what they do.
When you think about how your craft becomes involved, sort of documenting their life, whatever their project is, et cetera, talk about sort of stylistic choices you make. So when you enter into Walmsley's world, do you try to be this fly on the wall where he sort of barely notices you're there, if that's even possible? Or do things have to be very contrived and you're intentionally setting up scenes? I'd love for you to talk about how you make those editorial decisions.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we definitely think about the scenes, but we're not like storyboarding anything. Like it's not like a commercial where we're going to like script out every single shot and have him like walk into frame and like place the coffee mug here and then like look out the window and contemplate life. Like it's very much true documentary style where like I'm there like experiencing life and trying to like capture what happens in the best way. So that means that you just have to come to every scene that's planned or not planned with like an open mind and like your camera ready to go, which is easier said than done, because we shoot on like really big cameras, like true cinema quality cameras. And they're not easy to like turn on and just like hit record. Like my camera is the Red V Raptor, and it takes like 40 plus seconds to boot up and then like get everything dialed. And like, so I find myself kind of constantly anticipating what's going to happen whenever I'm like in an environment. And I like see Jim get up from the couch, and I was like, oh, he's going to go over there. I'm going to like turn on the camera now so that when he walks back, I can get the shot of him sitting back down in like the composition and frame that I want. So yeah, it's really just about like being open, being ready, and just curious and looking for cool moments. And then on top of that, having like a good relationship with Jim and Jess, like, as long as like the vibe of any shoot is good, like often the content is good. You really don't want to like have no conversation going on when the camera's off. Like, I don't know. I've been on shoots where it's like not a good vibe and it sucks for everybody. So.
Yeah. Cause there's a couple scenes, and I guess my definition would be sort of like sprinkle content where it's not quite the main thing, but it's the stuff that further humanizes the subject. I love the scene when you guys are in Chamonix and he pretends like he's Benny the Jet Rodriguez and he's about to sprint down that alleyway, or when, you know, he goes over to his neighbor to do the transaction for the carton of eggs, like that kind of content. I don't know if it was, again, so probably wasn't contrived, but I love that stuff.
Yeah. So it's this, that's again, where the relationship, like, it goes back to that, because the egg thing was Jim's idea. And I'm like, hey man, like, how can we, like, let's do something weird. Let's do something cool. Or like, what do you want to do? He's like, oh, we get our eggs from our neighbors. Let's go talk to him. So like, we just go do that real quick. And it was his idea. And then, the UTMB Jet Rodriguez start line thing was fun, because we were just walking around Chamonix in the summer, and Jim and Jess are just showing me the town, because I've never been there before, never even seen the race. And I'm like, where does it start? And they're like, oh, it starts right here. And I'm like, oh, dude, you got to do like some strides and I'll film it. And he's like, no, I don't want to do it. And I'm like, just do the strides, you'll be fine. And he's like, okay, fine. And then he like totally gets into it and like says this funny thing and like sprints. And I'm like, ah! So yeah, it's about just like, I don't know, joking around, having a good time, doing funny stuff. There's a lot of footage that is pretty ridiculous that was never included. Like, I'm hoping to make like a fun BTS cut of something at some point when we have time.
Well, I was going to say, there's a couple great films in our sport, like one on the 2010 Western States that comes to mind, and they just recently published it. JB Bennett was the director. They just recently published it to YouTube. But one thing that they did that I loved, because you just reminded me of this, is they then published all of their favorite outtakes. Mm-hmm. So there's the film, but then there are some of the outtakes, and this is just the whims of YouTube, right? Some of their outtake film videos, which are like, you know, 10 minutes long, it might be an interview between Anton Krupicka and Scott Jurek, for example. That thing's got like a million views and it's like barely trailing the main thing. So all of the sort of edge pieces of content that you never considered, they end up serving the marketing purpose great too. And
totally.
Yeah. It's amazing to me.
Yeah. After we went to Istria 100 in Croatia, we started, like, Jim and I started joking around about this thing called zombie mode, which is very true and specific to Ultra. But like, we've all probably played Call of Duty at some point. I don't know if you like have ever played like the Call of Duty zombies. And I was just like, okay, dude, what level zombie are you? Like mid race. It's just like, yeah, joking around like that is fun.
You mentioned that a lot of these projects can be rolls of the dice, and sometimes you'll return to a subject multiple times over a few years, because if the goal was, for example, to win UTMB in 2022 and it didn't quite happen, you're like, okay, maybe in 2023, you know, everything comes together, lightning strikes, and we got this, and this completes the film. Talk about that more, like how often some of these projects you take on can be dependent on the results, and how you work with sort of an imperfect storyboard, or do you just abandon projects altogether? Like, is there a graveyard out there?
There's definitely a graveyard of certain ones. Like, we've had some really cool projects that we have like completely finished, like ready to click publish, and they've just never seen the light of day because either an athlete got in like a tragic crash or something, or like they didn't win the race, or it doesn't sound good, or they said something that people don't agree with. So There's definitely a graveyard, but I actually despise filming events, and because they are so like dependent on the result, and you have no matter what event it is, the format in which you try to capture it is pretty much the same, and it's just this like kind of hustle bustle of leapfrog that you're playing with like the lead group, assuming or your athlete, whoever you're following. And you don't know what the result is. And like, we've had some projects like Jim's that is just like the Cinderella story at the end. It's like, I cannot believe he won this. And this is like awesome, but that's like very few and far between.
Yeah.
And I feel like most brands default to like, oh, let's go shoot this event because like everyone will be there, everyone's watching it. But in my experience, the shots you get are way worse. Like the storytelling is worse. The athlete doesn't want to do a film around an event. They want to focus on their race, which I respect because I used to be an athlete. And you just end up, unless it's somebody like Jim who like was invested in this project and wanted to do it and liked working with me, like that would have been a disaster. Like I was the only person that he let into his Airbnb the entire week leading up to the 2023 UTMB. Mm-hmm. He's like the center of the world leading into it, and like famous gym, everyone's asking him for interviews and he's like, no. But for some reason, Ansel's allowed to like be hanging out in his Airbnb like the whole time. I went on like his shakeout run where everyone's like, oh my gosh, that's Jim. And like him and I are just like running together with the camera. I think it could have gone so much worse, but luckily like Jim and Jess had so much conviction and hospitality and like belief in the project. And then it just all came together at the end, and it was a real like roller coaster of a ride, because mid race, like it felt like he was not going to win. And we're like, darn it. Like we did this whole year of filming for almost nothing, or like we would still make something out of it, but I'm like, okay, he's definitely not going to win. Like whatever, we'll have to figure out what to do. And then he just like comes back from the dead, and both Jess and I are just looking at each other like, what the heck? So yeah, I think people who watch the film kind of experience that, like, just like, holy crap. And like just being there in person, it was like 10x that, because we had poured so much into the project. To see it like fall apart and then come back together, I was just like, wow, this is wild.
I would be remiss not to ask this question, because like you said, one of the things that is so attractive about Jim, in my opinion, is he can be outspoken when he wants to be, but he's also so good at sort of selecting when to be reclusive and when to sort of tighten his inner circle and prepare for events. And like you said, with UTMB last year, he sort of went zero dark 30 mode and was just like at his chalet hanging out. I love that. You have unique perspective because you've done the pro athlete dance on the bike side of things. Do you have any recollections from sort of those few days leading into UTMB, observing Jim, how he was processing the lead up to that moment, and just how he was dealing with that amount of pressure?
I would say he's really good with the pressure. He just doesn't want to do the extra stuff that is the like dance, which I think is a great analogy for being a pro athlete. Like he's just a mad scientist. He wants to like tweak and really think deeply about all of his decisions and then like effectively communicate those decisions to his support crew. And then beyond that, he wants to do a shakeout run, he wants to pick up his number, and he wants to lay on the couch. Like, and that's what he should be doing. Like that's what a high performer tasked with that kind of mission should be doing. Like, and I thought it was really cool to witness like the devotion to the craft. And I think like we can all learn a lot from pro athletes who like do this kind of thing in our day-to-day lives. Like what if like I put that level of effort and thought into like answering an email? Like that would be wild. I don't think it's sustainable, but Yeah, really, really cool to witness. He's like this mad scientist that really cares deeply and is truly interested in like the data, the training, the nutrition, constantly tweaking stuff. And both him and I like enjoy talking about that kind of thing. So the little Strava scene was that we like shot kind of in like a dark hallway. Like, I think that was maybe, that was either the day before the race where we did a shakeout run, or it was like the morning of the race. And he's just like, hey dude, check this out. I haven't published it, but like, look at my training build on Strava. And it's like this perfect ramp. And he had just come off this ankle injury too, where he like actually tore a tendon in his ankle, but the doctor said that the tendon wasn't needed. So he just got PT and just ran on it. And I'm like, dude, your body is going to be so messed up in like 30 years. yeah, I don't know. It was really cool to witness firsthand, like very grateful to be let into that environment and group.
It sounded in your answer that his approach to ultra running may have even rubbed off on how you approach your art of photography and videography, and turning Jim's perspective on the sport and his approach to the sport into a story. Can you talk more about that? Like the answering the emails in like a more tasteful way. That was kind of
cool.
Yeah.
I mean, when you work with a high performer like that, you're like, I always leave those shoots kind of like with this new inspiration for my craft or my life. I'm like, oh man, I want to like go run again because I miss being an athlete. Or I'm like, wow, if he's putting in this kind of effort to this, like I need, like when we sit down to shoot the next interview, I want to be super freaking dialed and like have all these questions thought through. It's just like it kind of like, it goes back to that saying, like you're the average of the five people you spend most time with. So choose wisely. It's just kind of something like that, where it's just cool to be in the presence of high performers.
Yeah. So you mentioned Matt Porter earlier, and you mentioned that, you know, part of your opportunity in this side of the sport came through Wahoo. And I watched the film, and you can tell that it's a Wahoo film if you're really paying attention, but the marketing isn't in your face. And again, yeah, with your work, you probably get a great read on this. Is this the direction that more brands are going, where the ROI of doing a big project like this is a bit murky, and they're just sort of putting in this content to the space? They're injecting content that has just like broad appeal. And if they do that, they're going to bring entrants in that'll buy watches. Like, talk more about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the consumer is becoming increasingly intelligent. Like, everyone's a smart human being. Like, no one likes getting spam emails. No one likes getting blatant marketing in their face. Like, hey, buy this, buy this, buy this. So I'm a very firm believer in this, and I don't think many brands have caught on yet. So I think there's a big opportunity, but Matt definitely agreed with this approach and would actually have to fight for it internally at Wahoo a lot. Where you look to brands like the Yeti Presents series, which is a great short film series on YouTube. They do a lot of stuff in the outdoor kind of adventure-y space. You look to brands like Patagonia, where they're like, okay, what do we actually believe in? What story do we want to tell? Let's just go fund it. And maybe some people are wearing our product in it. Maybe there's a logo at the front, but other than that, that's it. And I think in a way it's like so much more powerful for a brand to do that, because it builds this relationship and trust and like just stoke from the brand. Like, they're like, wow, this brand just like made this piece of art. This is awesome. Or like told this story about this mission. I didn't know about this mission. This mission is really cool. I need to like think more about that. I think like there's so much low hanging fruit out there and so many stories to be told in that realm, that like any brand could take advantage of. And I think Matt definitely knew that and saw that with Jim. And then, yeah, you'd have to fight internally to like kind of like make those projects a reality, because you don't see like an immediate ROI. You can't like, no matter, we'll have all the analytics of the film, but you can't like attach those analytics directly to sales. But what it is like evergreen content and marketing, and will produce exposure and ROIs for years and years and years and years and years. Whereas like a 30-second, 60-second Instagram ad about a shoe or about a watch is like, will only produce an ROI when it has like ad spend behind it, and it's placed in front of somebody who you're tracking with cookies, who's clicked on the website and is already interested. So like that stuff all exists in the back end for anybody. But I think like when you look at the whole funnel, these brand stories and these hero stories that they kind of fit within the realm of branded content. But this is maybe a little bit beyond that, because it's like a feature length film. That kind of like, in my opinion, that's the most important and overlooked part of the entire marketing funnel. Everyone just like over indexing at the very bottom, where it's like, okay, we need to do like a 30-second like Instagram reel and get immediate satisfaction. So, and like that kind of happened with this film too. They're like, we had to push and fight Wahoo and Hoka so hard not to release it in 2023 because it wasn't ready. And I'm like, guys, this is gonna like, it doesn't matter when you release it. It just has to be released before UTMB 2024. So like, why would we release it and jeopardize one, not the quality of the film, because we'd be rushed editing it. Two, like if we wanted to do like a big film festival run, which we were like debating, and like potential like sale of it to Netflix or a big streamer like that. Like, why would we jeopardize all those opportunities just to like rush it and get it out like 2 months after UTMB, when people will be watching this for like years? So
years.
Yeah.
Do they have any, like when you are, for example, I don't know if you bidded for this project, or, you know, there was just this awesome inbound opportunity, regardless of sort of those circumstances, when you have the initial conversations around the film, are there any explicit conversations with the brands like Hoka, like Wahoo, where they say something along the lines of, this project will be successful if, like, they have some sort of deliverable for you? Is it just simply, let's just get as many eyeballs in this as possible? Is there anything at the bottom of the funnel? Talk about that.
Luckily, I don't get brought into too many of those conversations. Because I'm not like seeing it perform, but like, I'm not an analytic person. I used to like help run Instagram ads and Meta ads and Google ads for small businesses. And like, I just hated it. I can't stand the analytics side. But like, to your question of like, it'll be successful if, is, I think like in Walmsley's case, they had seen the view counts on the previous film. So they're like, okay, like we have him signed for another year or two. Let's make something else. Because the likelihood of it doing well in that view count is pretty good. But I think they think it's a success if like it hits over 50,000, 100,000 views on YouTube or something like that. So, yeah. I don't know what this will hit, but it's pretty crazy that it's already 200,000 views in 4 days. Easily the most well-received and watched piece of content we've ever done. So
I play the YouTube game quite a bit. I am fairly confident, just based on the current rate trajectory, it'll hit probably 1 million views by the time this thing publishes. So unless we publish this today, Friday, May 3rd.
No way. I don't know. maybe before... Maybe within a year it'll hit 1 million, but I bet it'll taper off pretty quick here shortly. But still, like, just, I can't believe that people are actually watching 90 minutes of gymisms, as Jess calls them.
Well, it shows that there's a massive gap or opportunity in the market, right? Like, you and Matt Porter and anybody else that believes in this model of brand marketing. I think that this is an awesome case study. Like, not only have you created an awesome film, but in my opinion, for anybody that's coming up behind you that wants to pitch similar projects in the future, they can reference like the Jim Walmsley type films of the world and say, look, there is a massive amount of demand, and you have to trust that even if it's 1 or 2% of people that take action on Wahoo after watching this thing, 1 or 2% on a million is amazing, right? Like, if you can add, again, I don't really do public math, but if you can add 1,000 or 2,000 new customers into your index, and the lifetime value there is whatever, thousands of dollars, like, bam, that thing paid for itself and probably grew the brand significantly.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's all positive exposure at the end of the day. Like, people might watch the film and might not even know what Wahoo is, but it will be kind of subconscious in their mind. And then when they happen to come out with a product that actually really speaks to them, like, for example, this new treadmill, which is completely crazy. I don't know if you've tested it out. Like, that's going to for sure change the running market for them in a really big way. Because at the end of the day, it is about like a good product. But if it's like subconscious in their mind, and then they like see something down the road, that's when something will convert. I feel like we all think it's like needs to be like immediate and like super trackable and like linkable. And that's just, I don't know, that's our human nature of trying to like overanalyze things. But yeah.
Also, thank you to Delta G Ketones for their support of the Single Track podcast. I've used exogenous ketones in my training and racing over much of the last 18 months, and these are the best in class. There are many benefits to using ketones in your training and racing. My personal favorite is that they improve cognition at exhaustion, which is one of the most important value propositions in an ultra running context. So if you're curious to try them yourself in a training and racing environment, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout on their website for 20% off your next order. And with that, let's get back to this conversation with Ansel Dickey. I'm just thinking also about how many traditional methods and structures have been blown up in recent years. Like, for example, and I'll say this for the record, I personally really enjoy film festivals. Like, I went to one of the trail running film festival stops in Seattle earlier this year to see their like 2023 rotation of things. It was great. But typically, I mean, from what I understand, in prior years, even now, trail like film festivals have been used sort of as a major piece of a launch strategy to get something into the public consciousness, to help it grow. But you look at what you've done here. I mean, it has not been a part of a film festival yet. And
funny stories there.
Go. Like, well, you went direct to YouTube, and I mean, like, you bypassed and you're fine.
Yeah. And it was kind of like in hindsight, I'm glad we did it that way, because we got a lot of positive feedback, like, and comments being like, thank you for posting this on YouTube ad free, like, not behind an outside TV paywall, not behind anything like that. And so that kind of like has reinvigorated me to like, okay, yeah, there is this like new form of publishing where the creator or the brand can really own the content versus like the traditional outlets. So I do think we're kind of living in this like Goldilocks zone of opportunity when it comes to all that stuff. But the backstory there is that like we actually got rejected and denied from a bunch of film fests.
Wow.
So why? I don't know. It definitely hurt my ego. I think in their defense, I can give you the whole story. Yeah. In like the film festival's defense, they have like limited spots for feature length things because they're so long. So from like an event promoting perspective, you have so many slots, like it's easier to fit in like short films throughout the day, but like you can only have, so you have two theaters and you have 3 days of a festival. Like there's only so much time you can fit into like having people watch like 90 minutes of a film. So I understand that point of view, and there's no real like, ultra is like such a niche sport that there's no real kind of specific festival around it. But the Trail Running Film Festival that you mentioned, reach out to them. They're like, no, we can't accommodate this. It's too long. And I'm like, okay, whatever. Have since gotten an email back from that guy, and he was like, hey, dude, I watched your film. It was awesome. Shoot.
My bad.
And we submitted it to Mountain Film, denied. Yeah. We submitted it to 5 Point Adventure Film in Wyoming, denied. And the like, we mapped out this master plan. I got in touch with this guy named Jonathan Retzik, who's Jimmy Chan's agent, through a mutual connection, and had this great conversation with him. He's like, yeah, I know who Jim is. I follow the sport. Like, man, I'd love to have him as an athlete, but we don't. But I'm happy to help you, like, roadmap this thing. And this was all happening late 2023. So I'm having these conversations in the background and then presenting the ideas to Wahoo and Hoka, like, hey, this is how we should launch this film because it's a really big deal. Jonathan Retzik thinks that we should hit X, Y, and Z film festivals, do a full film festival run, and then eventually, like, the goal is to always eventually stream it publicly for free on YouTube, but like, you have this whole huge buildup and hype beforehand, and like, maybe even a in-person event with Jim before the 2024 Western States or something like that, which would be really cool. And like, between Wahoo and Hoka's kind of marketing calendar is not like aligning and like synergizing, like no in-person event happened, and then we got denied from all these film festivals, and then time is ticking. So Wahoo's like, and Hoka's like, we just have to get this out. So like, we got like a week's notice. We kind of had everything ready, like the film was done, but there's a bunch of other stuff, like the SRT file for the captions and like a million different kinds of trailers, like what do we want the thumbnails to look like? All this stuff that we got like a week's notice to like hustle on and like finish so that they could hit publish on YouTube. And that's basically how it went. Like, we had this huge like master plan, and then they were just like, nope, nothing's working. We're just going to publish it. So we're like, shoot. But it makes me feel good that people like that method. Like, I think that's cool.
It's so two comments. It's so interesting to me that there are many residual practices and customs from an analog world of marketing that are still taken super seriously in 2024, and that you need to go through those gates before you necessarily go through other places where you can disseminate faster, quicker, and with more audience. And then two, that I mean, again, this is just speculation on my part, but when I think about what you were saying around conforming content to the film festival format, it makes me wonder how many people out there are needlessly modifying their art to make sure that they fit those sort of confines, and how many great projects have been cut at the knees needlessly because that it's tragic is probably like, you know, too strong a word, but I'm kind of sad to think that like there could be more Walmsley films out there that didn't go that route because they were like, got to make sure I do this, this, and this, and I got to make sure it's 10 minutes. And it's crazy.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. It definitely sucks, but it's also like maybe cushioned by the positive factor of that, like, say you are a creator, you can like publish this thing and have it go viral, or like you like build your own content, hosting it all yourself. Like, it's we live in a really kind of cool zone of opportunity right now with like unlimited access to information. And like, I didn't even go to college. I just like taught myself how to use these cameras and how to edit by doing it over and over again, and then watching YouTube videos. So like, I actually got kicked out of high school for smoking weed. So like, I'm like bottom of the barrel in terms of education. But yeah, it's just, we live in a really cool time. And I think if you're motivated and actually interested in something, like, there is no barrier anymore for you to like make a business or learn what you want to learn.
We don't have to go there, but that's crazy that you got kicked out for smoking weed.
Yeah. I mean, Killington Mountain School is a ski racing academy. I don't blame them.
I did get
kicked out, and then I had the opportunity to reapply and come back. So I did, and I came back as a day student instead of a dorm student. And that's around the time that I switched from alpine ski racing to cycling.
Okay.
I was a terrible alpine ski racer, hence why I was probably smoking a lot of weed.
I got to ask you a few more questions on Walmsley. And, so you got to know him pretty well.
Yep.
And you've obviously been a pro athlete yourself. You're super tapped in, for example, to the gravel bike scene currently.
Yeah.
Do you find that Jim sort of fits the mold of a pretty prototypical high-level athlete? Is he an anomaly? Does he remind you of anybody in other scenes? Talk more about that.
He's one of like I feel like a lot of the unfortunate part of the gravel scene is that a lot of the top tier athletes are just kind of doing it because they see it as like the next opportunity. And like, I don't see any of them actually really enjoying the craft. They're all kind of like playing this dance and game of like, okay, yeah, like I can pretend to have fun and then like also train as hard as I can, but pretend that I'm not training as hard as I can. And then like win these races and get sponsorships. Like it's like a weird dance that they're doing that I don't see like a lot of people finding fulfillment from. And Jim was like a breath of fresh air because he's like this mad scientist who may or may not be on the spectrum, who friggin' loves what he does. And he just wants to go out and run all day. And I was like, this is so awesome. Like this is so genuine and cool. And he owns it. And he's also like, I've done a lot of projects where we have to like pull teeth to like do a shoot with the athlete. And we're like, hold on, like, we're going to make like this. I realize that you want to train for your event, but like what we're doing here is going to like broadcast your story to a lot of people. And it's going to show you in a really good light. Like this is kind of part of being an athlete. And I've had experiences where like, even just to like do any sort of shoot out of their normal training routine or at a time of day that's good light, but maybe it's not the best time of day for them to be riding their bike. Like that's happened a lot. So in contrast, working with Jim, he's like, where can we shoot where it's going to look the best? What kind of light can we get? Like, can we add, like we did this trail in Flagstaff called Blue Dot, which is like his favorite trail.
On a Belden.
Yeah, he friggin' loves this. He just does laps up it because it's the steepest thing around. He's like, this is the only way I can train for UTMB here because it's like I need stuff that's steep. And there's this one tree on Blue Dot. I didn't notice it because I'm like underwater, just like suffering, trying to keep up with him while he's speed hiking. There's this beautiful tree and he's like, dude, you gotta like shoot this tree. Like people are gonna love it. And it's just cool to like work with an athlete who is like super devoted to his craft, but also like interested in the craft that I'm doing and like is kind of additive to that process. Mm. So that's kind of like a long-winded way of maybe answering that question. But
so from a motivation standpoint in gravel for the pro athletes, it's that bleak, like compared to the joy and the intrinsic motivation that Jim brings it. You notice that they don't have that. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm like, I'm maybe not the best person to ask cause I'm kind of jaded. I feel like I've done so many gravel projects now and been to so many events that I struggle to like find the same awe that I found like with the Walmsley project. So, and I don't think that experience, like we all go through life with this like silo view of our own experience. And that sometimes overlaps with other people. And a lot of times it doesn't. So it's important to remember, like my view is not the same view as everybody's, but I think I enjoyed this Walmsley project so much because it was so new and I was so curious and it was like something I'd never experienced or done before. And I go to a lot of these gravel events and I'm like, it's the same thing over and over and over again. And the majority of the athletes, with some exceptions, are just like retired World Tour pros who are kind of like riding this wave of sponsorship and money and attention and like doing this dance of like, I need to have the beer after, but I also got to do my intervals the next day so that I can actually win the race. So like, to me, that's not a fun dance. It's like a fun dance is going all in on something you really love and truly believe in. Like I think that's way cooler and way more respectful than like, I don't know, this kind of like half seated thing. Like no one in the gravel space wants to take it super seriously because it evolved out of being not serious, but like everyone's taking it really seriously because you have to, if you want to like beat the next guy. So it's like this weird undefined kind of like thing that, I don't know, that's kind of like my take on like the broader view of things right now. At least on that, and this is only like the front end of the race. Like we're not talking about like the 98% of the people who have a friggin' great time riding their bike. Like that is genuine and beautiful and I love that. But like I operate in this world where we film like these high performers at the very front end, and that's kind of like what's going on there.
This is more just a comment on the industry at large and not reading into your situation, but it makes me think that from a agency standpoint or a content creator standpoint, it could be possible to have post-traumatic stress disorder from not finding another artistic outlet or a compelling subject after you encounter somebody like Walmsley who just made things right so joyful, so easy.
For
like,
sure.
The trauma of not being able to like find another home for your creativity in terms of athlete subjects. It's kind of wild to think that could happen.
And it could definitely happen. I have a lot of ideas though. Like one thing I'm pretty excited for, like on a personal career, is just like being able to now pitch films either to brands or organizations about like either a human story or a mission that I really believe in. And like to double down on like a project that you're like truly interested in. And like, that's part of the documentarian journey, is that like, if you're actually interested in it, like your questions are so much more sharp and you're like exploring this topic. Like, yeah, you should do your research and know about like what you're doing, but coming at it with this sense of curiosity and motivation really helps, instead of just kind of like, okay, this is the work, I've got to like go do this and then like chop it up this way because the client wants it this way. We do a lot of that work and it pays the bills. Like we have 3 employees and they're all awesome. So we need to do that work and we are grateful to have that work, but like we're also pretty excited to like do some like really cool kind of either spec pieces or pitch certain ideas to brands that we really want to like stand behind.
Yeah. When you, I'm assuming maybe you went and checked out Jim's backlog of content. So for example, pre-race interviews he did on I Run Far, or maybe the Lighting the Fire series that he did with the Coconino Cowboys.
But after the first shoot that we went on, and I offended Jim like one of the first times we were there in Flagstaff, because he referenced the Coconino Cowboys and we're like on a shoot and I'm like, what's that? Like, he's like, what, how do you not know what that is? I'm like, I don't know, I didn't watch it. But then I had since went back and watched, but yeah, continue. Sorry.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, does it benefit someone in your position to have that backlog? Do you go back and use that as a reference for how you might craft the story, what questions you ask, or do you like having the blank slate?
I'm definitely more of a blank slate person. I'm incredibly dyslexic, hence why I didn't go to college. And having the backlog of like audiovisual content definitely helps. Like I'm very much an auditorial learner. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I watch a lot of YouTube videos at like 1.75 speed, just so I can get through it and like digest the content. I hope people aren't watching Walmsley at like 2x speed. But yeah, like the blank slate. Once I had that first encounter with Jim, I definitely started to do my homework and I was like, okay, this guy is actually like one of America's best trail runners by far. Like I should really know who he is. But it's kind of nice to also, I feel like sport in general kind of, I don't know what the word is, like makes superheroes out of, like the media makes superheroes out of like normal human beings. And it's important to remember that everyone at the end of the day, like, takes a poop in the morning and like has to put on their clothes, and like everyone's a normal human being. So, I don't know. I find that it's easier to take that approach when working with like somebody who is somewhat famous in their kind of own niche-y realm. But, yeah, I don't know.
One last quick break to thank Rabbit, the official apparel partner of the Single Track podcast. Rabbit has a few new arrivals on their website worth checking out, including new colorways for their High Country short sleeve t-shirt, their Shredder shorts, and one of my personal favorites, their Deflector sun shirts. Go check it all out at runinrabbit.com and feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout on their website for 20% off your next order. With that, let's get back to this conversation with Ansel Dickey. Do you have time to go a little bit longer? I know we're at the top of the hour.
I have time to go as long as you want. We're good.
Brilliant. Yeah. I think that what you just said there is a possible great takeaway, despite the amazement that Jim has accomplished in his career. He is a normal human being. He takes part as well in all of the normal human activities on a day-to-day basis. But what do you, if you could control the interpretation of this film, I'm not saying you want to, but if you could, what's something you would want viewers to take away from it?
Yeah. Like the takeaway. It's tough because it's like, it goes into so many, like the film goes into so many details and covers such a vast period of time. And there's no like main kind of succinct, like summary sum up, although I'd love to like read something if somebody who really enjoyed watching it has something like that, that'd be cool. But what I would want people to take away from the film is that like it's just important to try. Like it's important to keep trying and try hard. It doesn't matter what you're doing, but like that story of failure and then failure and failure and failure coupled with like devotion and motivation and sacrifice like leads to results. It might not be like winning UTMB, but you will make forward progress, and it's really cool. So like have faith.
You've mentioned the mad scientist description to Jim quite a bit, which I love. And you know, one of the things that Jim has talked about, maybe it's even referenced in the film, is how influential Jim has been on the sport the last 7 to 8 years in particular, not just athletically, but from a personality standpoint and a cultural standpoint. And I've always gotten the sense, this is just my interpretation on the scene, because I came into the sport about the same time Jim did. I always felt like from a cultural standpoint, it was important to sort of be dissembling and to really not show how much effort and intensity and focus and care goes into your craft. And I get the sense that he's changing that and that he is making it cool to be so obviously all in on what you do and all of the pitfalls, but also all the glories that come with that. And I love that, because for a long time, my sense was that you had to show this character of, I'm here, but I'm kind of disinterested in like, yeah, trail running is cool, but like, it's just trail running. I love that he's changed that.
Yeah, I do too. I think it's awesome. And I think ultra's a weird enough sport for like, when you look at it in the context of all sports from like a normal person, it's a weird enough sport that like when they see Jim lay out like a million gels before a race or something, like before Istria, that scene where it's all the never second stuff. Yep. A normal person looks at that and there's like, there's no way he's gonna eat all that. That's disgusting. And that's just so normalized in the ultra world. And so to like see him like take that level of care and thought into everything is like, I think it only improves his popularity as an athlete, because it increases the weirdness factor. People are like, what is he doing? That's crazy. He's crazy. But he's not crazy. If you want to like perform at that level within this niche sport, like that's what you have to do. So I think it's cool that he owns it. And Jim's this like interesting mix of like, he has like, I think a lot of people who don't know him might think he's cocky. And I think it's like the best form of cockiness. It's like the most genuine, hilarious, like unfiltered cockiness with like a laugh, like a friendly laugh behind it. That's not malicious in any way. Like I would call him like a very enlightened human being with a big ego. Like it's a cool mix.
I like that description. Enlightened human being with a big ego. All right. You were a pro athlete once upon a time. How did that time in your life inform how you approach content creation now? Like if there's a couple things that come to mind around just that influence on how you direct, et cetera, what would some of them be?
Yeah. I attribute a lot of any sort of success I have today from like the connections I've built or just like the life lessons I learned or the habits I built from like being a pro athlete. Cause I think like it, no matter what sport you're doing, it's such a hard thing to do and you suffer so much and you have to have so much motivation and drive all coming from within you that if you can just like apply 10% of that effort to normal work, you could probably do pretty well. But when it comes to filmmaking and photography and the creative side and like mainly working with these high performers, like I think we've carved out a niche where we were like, keep doing like these stories with a lot of high performers. And I think if you start connecting the dots, it's because like when I sit down and interview one of these athletes, I can like connect with them on a level because I've been in their situation, maybe not their exact situation, but and definitely not at the same level whatsoever. Like I was a very low level pro cyclist. But like people who have been an athlete can connect on a certain level and like sympathize and like just understand what's going on. And I think that really helps build the relationship, which then helps the conversation, which then helps kind of like the statements that they're going to drop in the film. One of my favorite projects that we've done recently is a Wahoo Frontiers film with Chelsea Sodero, who's this, she was like a world champion triathlete, won Kona 2 years ago. We filmed it in like 2 days in Davis, California at her parents' house. And like cinematography wise, not the best shoot we've ever done. Like doesn't look that good. Like we just followed her on a training ride. It's whatever. And we had like an evening to shoot some of her running, but like the interview we shot with her, she just drops these friggin' bombs of statements and it's so powerful and so cool. So I like to think that I can connect on a deeper level with a lot of these athletes versus, a lot of filmmakers like coming to this sport and like having never done it before. Or a lot of people who get these opportunities to work with a big name athlete, whether it's in like a commercial sense. So like Nike hires like a big ad agency out of New York to go do a shoot with like a famous runner. And I guarantee you everybody on set probably isn't a runner. Mm-hmm. And in some areas that could be good because you're coming at it from a really like creative, different background and approach. But I think in this, medium of like longer form storytelling and really connecting with the athlete, like we're not inserting sound bites into their mouth. Like everything I'm getting out of them is like a real honest question. So I think it helps having that like background of sport as a whole.
Have you gotten to the point where you'll only take projects that you can see yourself truly getting interested in? And for example, the questions that come from you are like you just frothing at the mouth waiting to ask them forever? Or do you also find that you'll work your way into something and maybe the interest comes after the fact, but it comes?
The interest definitely builds. Like a lot of the ideas aren't ours originally. Like at least the ideas of the project, they're normally like we have a client and the client has an athlete or a host of athletes that they've signed and they need to do a project with them within a certain amount of years. So we're kind of told who we have to shoot and what we have to like make. But beyond that, it's like, I'm crafting all the questions. So I've got to like, even if I've never met the person before, I'd like do a little bit of research and like, okay, like who is this person? Like, what is their sport? What is their story? So the interest definitely builds over time. And then like here and there we get to like throw our own ideas around and sometimes clients buy it, but yeah, I would say a healthy mix.
I guess last question on this front, is it a good market right now for people in your trade? Do you feel like, yeah, it's a good market in the sense that like you can carve out a decent living. It's fairly easy to come across work, or do you feel like you're always on the precipice of ruin and things are tough? Like what's your sense on the market right now for photographers, videographers, stuff like that?
I think that there's way more than enough work to go around for anybody who wants it. I have like an incredibly optimistic view on the space, but I've talked to other creators who like it's doom and gloom. And I'm like, how, what? I don't understand. Like there's so many, like we've said no to a lot of things, not because we don't want to do it, just because we don't have time. And yes, we could like build the business and hire more people to like try to take that on. But at the end of the day, that's not really my goal. So I do think it's a good market. I just think you have to be like hungry and want to work and like actually enjoy it. And enjoy kind of like the parts that a lot of people don't enjoy, which is like actually the editing of stuff. Like we have our longest standing employee right now is Kristen Sundquist, and she's amazing. I help edited the first monthly film and then maybe like a quarter of this final film, but she really edited like the majority of these 90 minutes. And it's just like a heroic task to do something like that. And I still edit a ton of our other shorter projects. And she doesn't accompany a lot of shoots, but she did come to, she saw Jim win in 2023, which is cool. So she had an attachment to this project like I did. But yeah, I think you just have to enjoy the like entire process of it, from like conception to pre-production to production to post-production to like then the marketing and delivery of something. So if any, yeah, I don't want to say like a controversial statement, but like, I think there's a lot of work to go around. I think if someone doesn't think that there's a lot of work to go around, it's probably because they're not enjoying some aspect of the process and clients don't want to work with them because of that.
Switching to, there's one more thing I want to make sure we cover, and that is Vermont Overland. So you've got the run component to it. You've got the bike race component to it. And I'd love to hear you talk about the vision for this and the vibe you want to create, because I'm particularly interested in events right now. Yeah. And in our sport, there's a huge clash culturally going on between the grassroots and the more professionally, I shouldn't say professionally organized, but more commercially viable, commercially focused operations.
Can we talk about the UTMB Zach Miller drama?
Can talk about whatever you want, but like I would, as somebody who has also worn and continues to wear a race director, event director hat, I'd love to hear you talk about some of the choices that you make and that you don't make to go in one or both of these directions.
Yeah, I think it's a hard balance. To back up, for people who don't know, Vermont Overland like started out as like a 4x4 kind of Land Rover guiding company in Vermont, founded by Peter Vollers, who was my cycling coach when I was a young tween. And what Vermont Overland was also like my first client when I founded Vermont Social, which we started out like kind of doing social media and like Google ads. And Peter Vollers gave me this opportunity to like start the Instagram page for Vermont Overland, and I would help out with the events. And it went from 4x4 guiding company to gravel race supported by all these really cool vintage Land Rovers and 4x4s. And that was right around the time that the gravel scene was kind of exploding in the US and just starting out. So it saw this like explosive growth, and I got to help the growth with the marketing we were doing and got more and more involved in the events. And then in COVID 2020-ish, Peter's wife, Kim, got her dream job out in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at this place called the Los Poblanos Inn, which is like a beautiful inn. If you've been to Woodstock, the Woodstock Inn, it's like that, but Southwest vibes and much nicer. So she now runs that place, got her dream job. She was like, Peter, I'm going to New Mexico. You can come or not come. I don't care. So Peter's like, okay, I guess I'm going to New Mexico. And at that time, like, the bike race sells out within 10 minutes for like 1,000 people. So, and registration day is always January 1st at 9 a.m. It had already sold out. And Peter's like, I'm moving to New Mexico. I'll be back in August to promote the event. And I'm like, okay, let me know what you need. Maybe like June or July rolls around and it's still COVID or the year after COVID. And he's like, I'm not going to be able to come back and promote this event. Do you want the business? You can have the business if I'm able to keep a year's worth of entry fees, because it had already sold out and that money was in the bank. So I'm like, sure. Yep. I think I can make that work. But I'm also terrified because I, up until this point, have never like promoted or hosted the event. So my wife and I take it on, and like we get some more sponsors to like raise enough money to actually do the event that first year and host it. And then, yeah, luckily it went well and we were able to like keep it going. And then throughout this process, I like discover the sport of running and do this mainly through this gym project, start running it more and more through it. And I'm like, oh man, like the gravel race of Vermont Overland is such a cool format, and like people love it because it's not like anything else in the cycling scene. Especially, it's not like any other gravel race aside from a couple others in Vermont, just because Vermont's a very unique topography and has unique roads. I was like, this doesn't exist in the sport of running, or at least all the running races that I've gone to like aren't like this at all. Like, I should just start a running race. So we started that. And I think from an event promoting perspective and like a business perspective, you have to appeal to just like enthusiasts and the broader audience. And it's about growing the sport. It's not about catering to the top 1% or people like Jim. But you do have to like support and seek out people like Jim, because they're the people who get more like consumers and general people like involved or inspired and wanting to try a new event. So it is this balance of like needing to have some of those athletes, but like really focusing and like building the product and supporting everybody who shows up to the event. So it's about the person who finishes last just as much as it is about the person who finishes first. And at the end of the day, you just have to like build a really well-rounded product. And I've learned that kind of like the hard way too, just like maybe over-marketing like the front of the race a couple of years, and like people being like, hey, like I would have really appreciated like some more attention to the aid stations instead of like hiring another photographer to like cover the front of the race. So I think to answer your question, they're both important and it is a balancing act. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is just like creating a product that people are stoked to get when they sign up for an event, no matter who that person is.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, and I am also super ignorant of the gravel scene, but I've heard some people say that like you take an event like Mid-South, for example, that is a good example of a race that has gone large scale, but it's been able to maintain like the soul component. Is that something that you agree? Would you reference Mid-South as a good example of like having your cake and eating it too?
I think it's literally the only It's the last standing large scale of gravel event that still has a soul. And it's only because of the promoter, Bobby Wintle.
Really? Like, what does he do?
He owns a bike shop called District Bicycles in Stillwater, Oklahoma. And I think his first passion in life is like rock music and being a musician and playing the guitar. And he discovered, always wanted to be a rock star, but then he like kind of became rock star in this like backhanded way by hosting this crazy gravel event called Mid-South, first called Land Run 100. Yeah, I think it's like they've maintained their soul because of him. Like, he does a really good job of like throwing this insane party and like capturing it in a really cool way, but also like just like genuinely loving that everyone is out there kind of experiencing the same thing. So, and it's hard. It is like he maintains this energy level that I could never even dream of on event weekend. Like, hugging every single person that crosses the line, whether it's like the 50K run or the 100-mile bike race, and just maintaining this level of stoke that puts a smile on your face. So I think that's where the soul comes from. And they're a big race. Like, they do a really good job marketing. We've helped shoot it with their crew for like 3 or 4 years now. And they do a really, really good job. And I think they have no prize money, but athletes want to, they're not part of any series. They're not part of the lifetime thing. But it's kind of the first big race of the year, and athletes really, really want to win it because of the media attention that it gets.
I'm looking at the Overland site right now, not to pivot back too quick, but I pulled it up because I wanted to just kind of look at some of the features. We're a week away.
I know.
Oh my God. I didn't realize it's like next weekend.
Yeah. I know. We're in good shape. We've got everything pretty dialed. Compared to the bike race, the run is a lot easier to host because it all stays in West Windsor. I only have to do one town event permit, so I only have to talk to one select board. We have like an incredible crew of volunteers who have like, one thing that I've found doing the events is that it has gotten easier and easier year after year, because as long as you continue to work with like the same contractors, the same people, the same organizations, the same volunteer list, like it kind of becomes this like evolving team that just kind of knows what to do. So I think if you asked me like 3 years ago that we're a week away, I'd be like a stressed out space cadet, but I'm feeling pretty good now.
And you do take care of the top of the race. You've got decent prize money.
Thanks to Tracksmith, yes. So we don't have prize money in the bike race, and that's by design, just because we don't need people hucking themselves down hills in Vermont on gravel bikes for prize money. Plus, to be honest, like, we can't really accommodate any more people that sign up anyway, and the race sells out. So we don't feel like we need to seek out more top tier people to then seek out more general participants. It's just not part of the strategy. But the trail run is small. I really want to grow it. I think it could be just as cool, if not cooler, than the bike race. And I thought like offering like real deal prize money with like the big checks and everything would be sweet. So this is now the third year that we've had that same prize purse. And I think, like, I don't know, we don't do a good job marketing it within the running space just because we're not runners, and we're not on any of the like USATF stuff or what is it? ATRA.
Sure.
I think we have a membership, but I don't think we're on like their event calendar. Yeah, I think we're kind of like doing it from this back-ended approach in our own way, which I kind of like. But it's been slow and organic, nice growth. Like, we have more people than we did last year. Last year we had more people than the first year. So I'm pretty pleased.
The ambiance, the scene, I've been to that area of Vermont. It's beautiful. Do you want to integrate at any point with a larger race series? Like, would you want to get involved with like Golden Trail or anything where people could do this part of a circuit?
I mean, yes, if that means that it would expose the race to more people, because I think the course is truly unique. my whole idea with the event is similar to the bike race, which is you're constantly, the surface that you're on is constantly changing. And what the bike race does is it bridges the gap between like a road cyclist and a mountain biker or a cyclocross racer. And in a format that's not too long, it's not an ultra event, it's not 200 miles in Kansas, but it's incredibly technical, it's incredibly climby, it's hard, and it's intense and fun and short. And I really wanted to do that with the trail run and just bridge this gap between like the road runner, because I've done half marathons, I've done a bunch of road races, and I've done some trail events, and there's nothing in between. And the unique part of West Windsor and the Scutney Basin area is that you have, it's kind of like if you're a mountain biker and you know East Burke, like West Windsor is the less known East Burke Kingdom Trails. Like there are so many swaths of private land with beautifully maintained single track that connect from class 4 road, which is like double track on maintained dirt road, to like beautiful dirt road. And the kind of loop and course you can create in a landscape like this is just so cool. And like to have a race format with real prize money, hopefully with fast people, I think is just like at an arbitrary distance. Cause the one thing I don't understand about running, I'm like, why does it have to be a 5K, 10K, half marathon or marathon? Like, why can't it be about the course and about like the terrain, whether it's fast or not fast and really climby? Like, I think the number is kind of pointless. It's more about like the course and what you see and like how it makes the race unfold. And that comes from the sport of biking, where it's not about the distance. It's about like the course and where you're going and how that kind of affects race dynamics. So that's the like mission I'm trying to like pursue with the sport and the trail running event. But we'll see if it catches on. It's a slow battle.
Is event directing good business? Do you enjoy this side of your work as much as you enjoy the
It is way more side? Stressful.
Really?
I definitely like, I view the filmmaking and the production agency like more as my kind of like long-term career path. And like the event directing thing is like something I've stepped into and like I've been called and forced to step up to because Peter left and I want to see this event continue because it is really cool, but holy crap, it is so stressful. And you work a different part of your brain than the creative side. So the biggest problem I have is like switching from like super creative, intrinsically motivated, like inspired, trying to create something to like spreadsheets, logistics, emails, all sorts of stuff like that. So it's definitely a battle. I enjoy both. I think like the payoff, the trail run doesn't make money. The trail run is basically funded by the bike race at this point, but as a whole, it's a nice like side income for my wife and I who live locally. I don't think we could do it if I didn't do the agency stuff, because like that helps feed the marketing and then like some vice versa, but not much. So,
yeah. Well, Ansel, this has been a joy. I really appreciate this conversation. We will make sure to link to your LinkedIn, the Overland Race, film, all in the show notes. I always like to give the guest the last word. Do you have any final thoughts or calls to action or touching on any other topics before we go?
I don't know. No, I really appreciate being on. It's like awesome to be interviewed. I've interviewed a lot of people, so you do a good job and I appreciate the questions. And a call to action. I don't know if there's any like crazy human being with a really cool story out there that no one is really thinking about or is knowing of, like I'd love to know about it and like see if we can pursue it and build it into our plans and make something out of it. Because I feel like they're everywhere. It's just, you just got to discover them.